Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 288, and we're going to talk about different kinds of van lifers. That is, which are you? The person who wants to solve everything themselves, or the person who looks to others? We're also going to talk about, those 400-watt solar panels. Yeah, we're going to have a little talk about those. Can you use a different tank with your diesel heater and a place to visit that is, quite dangerous? Because, hey, we all need a little bit more danger in our lives, don't we? No, we don't. We're driving around in mostly self-built, unregulated, and often illegal vehicles filled with explosive gases and liquids at high sometimes it's best just not to think about what we're actually doing here. But it's all fine, I hope, because you're listening to me now, and I'm hoping you're doing so from a place of comfort and warmth, and it's even better if that is in your very own van or SUV or car or trailer or cardboard box, wherever you may happen to find yourself. It has been a time. Van Fest is still present in my mind, and I think I have four more interview segments to air, but this is not an interview show, so I don't want to just do them all right in a row. So for those of you folks who I've interviewed, it's coming, I promise. I have not thrown anything in the trash, so it is going to air, but I don't want too much of that because this is a magazine style show and those things have to come as bonuses or inserts. I appreciate everyone who has given me their time such that I may interview them, and I promise your content will get out there. But this week I want to talk about something that occurred to me during my VanFest experience, but also at a few other times in life. And this all started way back, probably 2010, maybe 2011. I was visiting with some old friends in Florida, in the Fort Lauderdale area, folks I used to work with at the James Randi Educational Foundation, and we went out to dinner. I think we were having seafood, which seemed appropriate, and they brought a friend along. And so we were talking about, who are you, what do you do, that kind of a thing, the thing people do, and I offered, at that time in my life, I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but I offered my thing, and they offered theirs. And as the night went along, I realized there was a vast difference between me and them, where I tended to talk about things I did and could do and skills I learned and things like that when it was appropriate. And they talked about people they knew and people they'd met. And whenever something came up as though it was a problem needed to be solved, I had a strategy, or at least I offered a strategy or a tactic or some experience, and they offered a person. And in fact, at one point, they pulled out their contact book and showed it to me and showed just how many people were in their contacts. And it occurred to me that this is not how I am at all. I am somebody who hardly ever asks anybody for help about anything, much to a stupid degree. I'm saying, do not emulate me. This is how I am, but it's not good. I will avoid going to the doctor. I'll avoid going to the mechanic. I hate getting my hair cut, although doing it myself doesn't seem reasonable. These are normal everyday things that I think people, healthy people, should actually go out and seek help with. But I'm reticent to do any of those things. And this person, on the other hand, everything is done through other people. And at the end of the day, an expression I really should stop using, we get where we need to be. And it occurs to me that in van life, there's a lot of similarity here. There are van lifers who, because of where they are in life and how they chose to spend resources, and they would have to have resources to do this, didn't build out their own van and didn't do any of the maintenance on it, or actually much of anything. They literally bought a van so they could go hit the road and live the lifestyle. And that is perfectly legitimate. It's just very different from people like me and others who have bought a van, and often cases an old van, and built it out through trial and error and YouTube University and all these different things, doing whatever it takes to get the thing done. And of course, in between those is a continuum of folks who were like, well, I'm okay with the electrical, but this plumbing stuff is a pain. I'm going to go ask my brother-in-law who's a plumber to help me with that. Again, none of these are wrong. This is all a way to get the job done, and that is what your goal is. You're trying to do something. What are your resources? But it occurred to me that in the van life community, there is almost a division between those folks who have resources of money and people, and those folks who have resources of skills and time and determination. I would count determination as a resource. It's actually a very important resource because, as I've said several times on the show, you can overcome other resources with determination. If you don't have enough money, you can overcome that with determination. In some cases, it's not universally true. So why is this? Are we socialized like this? Is it something genetic? I don't actually know, but I would guess outside of any authority whatsoever that it does have something to do with the way we're brought up. And I wish I could do a study of van life folks to see, you know, are the DIY people, do they tend to be folks who were somehow more isolated? And the people who think of people as a resource, if they grew up in a large family or in a city or in some sort of big church community or something like that. I don't have any statistics to offer you. But I know for me, I grew up an only child, no siblings. It's the same thing. That was the word for that is redundant, yes. And, you know, I spent a lot of time alone. I mean, that's how that works. And I also spent a lot of time wanting to solve problems and wanting to find answers and having no people as resources to use. I would try to do it on my own. And I did. I mean, you know, so I learned that skill of how to rely on myself, basically, which is a very good skill to have. But I wonder if other people who come from large families, you know, if you're the middle child, you have resources of, guessing here, younger siblings that you can trick into doing things for you, and older siblings who, if they're not busy doing mean things to you, might actually help you with the experience they have. I experienced none of that, and that's why it's such a vast difference for me. However, I am challenging both camps on both sides, whether you're the person who has a whole big contact list filled with people who can help, or you're somebody who doesn't know a soul on the planet, but you know how to take apart your engine with a crescent wrench. Those two groups of people, I'm encouraging you to try to aim a little bit more towards the middle of the bell curve, where you employ both resources. Because after all, the more resources you have, the more things you can do. And nobody is good at everything. I am not good at anything. I am a very broad individual. I am capable or almost capable in a wide range of things. I'm not an expert in anything. And thus, it's hard for me to rely on other people because I can almost do what they do. I would be better off if I could ask for help more often. And something I, even talking about this, I'm uncomfortable suggesting that. That's how built into me it is that I need to do this myself. Folks, I'm having a revelation as I record this. This is part of my attraction to AI chatbots because they're a resource that replaces a person for me. Interesting. I will think more on that. But anyway, hey, let us dispense with the fourth wall here. This show is nothing if not of the moment and honest in this case. Anyway, I shall move on. So think about this. When you're looking at your van life, which kind of person are you? Are you the kind of person that when they encounter a problem, you will instantly go find another person to help you with that? Or are you the kind of person that when you encounter a problem, you're going to do it yourself, you just have to figure out how? If you can be a combination of those two, I think you're going to be the most successful you can be. But both sides anywhere on this spectrum can be equally successful. I have met the people who have turned nothing into a palace and the folks who have simply bought a palace. And they both have something in common. They're doing what they want to do. And I think that's what matters. If you're doing what you want to do, you have succeeded. How you get there is up to you. But I'm going to hope to offer you some things that might help you get there. I mean, that's kind of the point of this podcast. So, hey, here's an assignment for you if you would like it. I'm not going to assign anything and expect anyone to actually do anything. But my assignment is, if you are the kind of person who tends to do everything yourself, try asking for help on something. Doesn't have to be severe. You don't have to go crazy and pay someone to redo your rig or anything. But for one thing relating to your rig, just try asking for some help somewhere where it makes practical sense and gives you some practical good. And on the other side, if you're someone who has lots of resources and they revolve around money and people, and somehow those are related because you have to pay people to help you in many cases, try to figure out something yourself. If you have never figured out the difference between a converter and an inverter, for example, figure it out. Or if you don't know where the water pump is in your rig, figure out where that is and figure out how your water pump turns on when you turn on the faucet and then turns off when you turn off the faucet. How does that work? I mean, this thing's electric. Water's not electric. Figure those things out. And if you do this assignment, you will find that you have added another arrow in your quiver to help you be successful in what you're trying to do with van life. A special thanks to Steve and Terry and some anonymous person who was very generous because they've all bought me gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Folks, there are no ads on this podcast. I'm constantly being begged by my host to put ads on the podcast, and I continually say no because this model is working. I'm bringing in enough money to support the podcast. It's not about getting rich. It's just about paying the bills, and this is doing that, and that is great. So if you would like to help out the podcast, you may visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go and buy me some gallons of whatever you'd like. Heck, if you want to put in the comments what you're buying me gallons of, that would be fun. And if you can't do this, if you're not in the financial state where you can donate, that is completely fine. And also, if you're just not sure if I'm worth it, that's fine too. Whatever, it's all okay. Special thank you to the folks who do this every month. And thank you for allowing me to have a show without ads. It makes everything nicer for everyone, and I really appreciate it. Again, that is at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. Thank you. Van life news. Been a while since we had some news, and I've got some good news here, which is great. Actually, depending on how you look at it, this could be three pieces of good news, but one of them comes with a lot of warnings. First off is, I've done an interview with an RV tech named Sherm, which I will be releasing to you as soon as I can. It's a very long interview. It's going to be an entire episode, probably over an hour long, where we talk about all aspects of RV tech life and how it relates to van life. He's a van lifer too, so it's a really interesting perspective. But he dropped this piece of news on me that I have to share with you now, is that he has heard that some Camping World locations will do installation work on DIY builds. That means if you're afraid of putting solar in your rig and you want someone else to do it for you, your Camping World might do it for you. Now, I haven't done all that much research into this. It might be a case-by-case basis, and there might be times when they're going to say no, they're not going to do it. But I bet if you have an empty van and you want solar installed, but you want a professional to do it, Camping World would probably do it for you. Yes, you're going to pay more to do that than to do it yourself. That's how it works. They have bills to pay too. But it is a way to get it done. It is a resource. So that is something to think of. If maybe for those of you who do everything yourself and you're afraid of one aspect, maybe Camping World can be that personnel resource that you're lacking. But it was a good piece of news to hear because I know a lot of RV dealerships will just turn away anybody who has any kind of DIY build. But Camping World is apparently, at least to some extent, opening the doors. Camping World has a mixed reputation. I am not supporting them or rejecting them or anything like that. I am just passing along the news. Also, another very important thing to me is that RMSS registration is open. What is RMSS? Well, I'm glad you asked, of course. It is the Rocky Mountain Star Stair. Now, this event is not a van life event, but it is an event that really fits well with van life. Let me explain. The Colorado Springs Astronomical Society, this is Colorado Springs, Colorado, has been putting this on for years, and it is the premier star party of the Rocky Mountains. To be clear, this is an event where you go out in the middle of nowhere and the sky is completely dark and you can see the entirety of the universe as much as you can. But I can tell you that folks here have seen objects with the naked eye, aided by telescopes, like Charon, the moon of Pluto. People have seen that from scopes at this event. I mean, that's, if you know anything at all about astronomy, even a really low level, seeing Pluto's moon through a telescope is amazing. Now, weirdly, I actually don't like looking through telescopes, so what I do with this event is I sit back in my chair and look for man-made objects. For some reason, that's what interests me, and I use an app to track them, and I'm like, ooh, here's a piece of a Russian booster from 1968 going by. See that dot right there? See it go? See, it's passing through Cassiopeia. There it goes. That's what I do at night. Now, this event, you're supposed to bring your own equipment to use to look at the sky, and if you don't, I have found that a lot of people will welcome you to use theirs, but you shouldn't expect it. That is a nice thing they do. But you don't really need equipment to have a good time here. It is primitive camping. They provide porta potties, but that's it. You should bring your own water and everything else. There is very limited electricity, not enough to hook your rig up to. But if you were the kind of person who's doing tent camping and needed to charge your phone, you could do that. There is a food truck there, so there is some food available. But hey, look at their website, learn more about this. I have been going for years. I love this event, and I hope to go every single year. Registration varies based on whether you're a member of the society or you're not. I think it's under $100 for 3 days, 4 days, really, of camping, and that's a bargain. It's a beautiful place regardless, and it's not too far from a lot of interesting things to see. Like, if you wanted to make a whole week out of it, there's a wolf sanctuary not far from there. Great Sand Dunes National Park is actually physically very close, but it's a bit of a drive because you have to go around the mountains. And it's not impossibly far from major cities. You know, Denver is maybe 3 hours away. This is a fairly easy place to get to, even though it's in the middle of nowhere. And it's beautiful, especially if you haven't really experienced Colorado. Well, anyway, I've said enough. I will be there. I will be there with other folks I know. I know there will be other van lifers there. And if you could come too, I think that would be great. But I have to warn you, this sells out quickly. So the dates are June 10th through June 14th in 2026. Make sure you read everything on the site and then get your tickets as soon as you possibly can. During the days, there's all kinds of activities. It's a really fun event. I also would ask you to remember one thing. This is an event for the Colorado Springs Astronomical Society, and they do allow visitors to register for this event, which is very generous of them. But remember that it's their event. This is an astronomy event for their club. Kids are welcome. Dogs are welcome. Of course, they have to be on a leash and taken care of. But anyway, read about it. I've talked too much, and I don't care because I love it. It's 7,600 feet of astronomical goodness. You can find out more at rmss.org or see the link in the show notes. And the last bit of news has a mixed bag. You may have heard that the federal government of the United States is no longer going to prosecute people who remove their emissions systems, their DEF and DPF and whatever else, swirl valves probably, from their diesel engines. So this is called a delete, and it's been a fairly common thing for folks who own diesel vehicles for a long time. It's basically where you modify your engine so that it doesn't need DEF anymore, doesn't have a particulate filter, basically all this stuff that if things go wrong, it kills your van. You remove all that stuff, and it was against the law because that stuff's there for a reason. It takes pretty harmful stuff out of the air, and the estimate I read somewhere was that it saves about 30,000 lives a year worldwide. So there's a reason why it's there. However, it does cause problems, and it's pretty much what killed my Sprinter. That's the area that my Sprinter kept having problems with, and that is not an uncommon story at all. So recently, the federal government has announced that even though the laws are still in place, they're not going to prosecute them. It's kind of the same way it is with marijuana. In the U.S., marijuana is still illegal at a federal level, but it's not being prosecuted. This is that same thing, although there's a big uh-oh here, and that is that local laws may still apply. And I can tell you that if you live in California and you delete your stuff and you get pulled over and they find it missing, you're going to get a very hefty fine. So, should you do this or not? I'm going to give you the pros and cons, and you can decide. The pros are, if you do this, if you delete your emissions from your diesel vehicle, you will have a vehicle that runs better, it may have more power, it may get more fuel mileage depending, and you won't have to pay for DEF anymore. It'll also weigh less because that stuff does have some weight. The cons of that are, as you will have turned a fairly clean vehicle into a heavily polluting vehicle, and you could still face legal problems, just not from the federal government. You still have to worry about your local government. So you make the decision there. I'm not going to give you resources on how to do this. You can Google them and find shops that might be willing to do this. But while you're looking at that, also look at what's happened to people in the past who've redone this and some of the prosecutions and see who was prosecuting. It may not have been the federal government. I have a link in the show notes for a great article about the pros and cons of deleting DEF from truckinginfo.com. Be sure to read that before you go any further in this project. Tech Talk. If you have a diesel heater, do you need to use the tank that came with it? So this is an interesting question because when you buy a diesel heater, it comes with one of two different kinds of tank. It's either going to come with this flat square tank, or it's going to come with this kind of squat, like a quart of milk on its side size of tank. And that's the kind of tank that you find in the all-in-one units. They basically put the tank on the top. But that's the key here. They put the tank on the top. And in the flat tank, where you have to drill the hole yourself and put the fuel pickup in, that is at the bottom. The key point of the tanks that come with diesel heaters is they're using gravity to help the fuel get to the diesel heater. Now, why would you want this? Well, it makes less work for the pump. Basically, that's it. The pump has to work less hard if there's a bit of head pressure on the fuel coming through. So the question is, what if you don't want to do that? Like, what if you have a tank you want to use? And I'm not talking about the diesel tank in the vehicle. You know you can do that. If you have a diesel tank in the vehicle, there's all kinds of stuff on how you can use that. But that kind of answers the question, doesn't it? Because where is the fuel tank in your vehicle? It's definitely below your diesel heater. I don't think anyone's mounting their diesel heater below the tank, which means that the fuel from there is being pumped uphill, and that means that you can do that. And the answer is, absolutely, you can use your own tank, and it may create a little bit of extra work for your pump. My Sprinter was piped directly to the tank under the vehicle, never had a problem. And in my new rig, well, I can tell you that my diesel heater is running fine off of a plain old gas can that I drilled a hole in. So the answer is yes. If for some reason you don't want to use the tank that came with your diesel heater, you can use any tank approved for fuel. You may need to modify it a bit, and you do have to worry about venting and things like that, because as the fuel is drawn out of the tank, air has to get into the tank, else the tank will start collapsing, which you can find videos on where people didn't vent their tanks, and the pump was actually strong enough to draw enough pressure out of the tank that the tank began to collapse just from atmospheric pressure, which is impressive. So, if you hate your diesel tank, which I understand because the ones that come with it are very prone to leakage, they're not very well molded. But yeah, if you've got a situation where, I really want a diesel heater, but I can't figure out where to put the tank, you can use all different kinds of things for tanks. They just have to be able to hold fuel and let some air in. Product review. I'm going to go back in time here, and I've already mentioned this recently, but I recommended a 400-watt solar panel, portable solar panels from Vivor, and I still do. However, I'm going to say this again because I want everyone to know this. It's important. Those 400-watt solar panels, best as I can tell, are wired as two 200-watt arrays in series. Now, let me explain why that matters. Solar panels produce voltage, and your solar controller or your power bank, depending on what you're charging, power banks tend to have solar controllers built into them, is expecting a range of voltage. The voltage changes depending on how much sun they get, but there is a baseline of voltage and a max voltage, and that's the range. If you have your basic 100-watt panel and a solar controller, you can look for somewhere between, for operational range, maybe 18 to 23 volts, maybe 18 to 25 volts. Again, it varies a lot. Once the voltage falls below a certain point, then you're not getting any energy from the controller. MPPT controllers are better at this than PWM controllers. Now, if you have two panels, what do? If you wire them in series, you double that voltage. Then you've got 40 or 48 volts. Well, that's where there is a problem. If your battery bank can't handle more than 30 volts, you can't charge it in with those panels wired like that. And these 400-watt panels produce between 40 and 50 volts. What that meant for me at VanFest was that I couldn't use them to charge any of my three power banks that I brought. None of them, even the Jackery 1500, could handle that much voltage. And that's bad. That was very bad when I figured it out when I got down there, and I couldn't charge anything. If you have standalone batteries and you're using a solar controller, you're probably fine. You just have to check the voltage range on your controller. So those panels were great. And when everyone came to see my rig, well, I'd say 80% of them didn't care at all about my rig. They wanted to talk about those panels. The panels are solid. They're as far as portable panels go, these things are rugged. They have these big hefty stands that come out. They didn't care at all about the wind. I didn't stake them down or anything. They didn't care. And they were fairly easy to reposition to kind of follow the sun. So they produced a good amount of power too. So the panels are great. And last time I checked, they were only $225 on Amazon. So the panels are wonderful. You just have to know that they're producing between 40 and 50 volts because they're wired as two panels in parallel connected to each other in serial, if that makes any sense. It doesn't have to make sense. All you need to know is those numbers. So before you run out and get this, which I recommend, again, these are great portable panels. This is a beefy portable panel array. Make sure that whatever you're trying to charge can handle that much input voltage. If you're using a standalone MPPT controller of basically any kind, you're fine. But if you're trying to charge your power bank, make sure you read the fine print and see if your power bank can handle over 30 volts, basically. And my Jackery 1500, which is a slightly older model, could not. Tales from the road. I don't think I've ever fully told the story of my first rig, or at least my first thing I could call a rig. You know, I mean, I slept in my cars ever since I've had a car. I've done everything in my cars ever since I've had a car. But the first thing I would call a rig was this unit I got in 1985. No, it was 1986, and I got it in one of those Auto Trader newspapers, and because that's how it was done back then. We didn't have the internet. There was no Craigslist or Marketplace or anything like that. News papery thing that came out once a week, and you'd look through and see what the ads were, and people paid to put ads in there, and very tiny print, you're just going down, it would like Toyota, 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 and I saw this one, it said Toyota Chinook. Toyota Chinook? Toyota never made anything called Chinook, and I found out that this was this RV. This was before I worked at any RV place. I only had the vaguest notion of RVs. You know, I knew there were Winnebagos. But I saw a picture of one of these once, and it was a Toyota pickup truck, the little Toyota pickup trucks, you know, what we call the Hilux back then. They still sell Hilux in countries outside the U.S. But it was a small, little pickup truck, and the back was cut off. It was a cutaway, and the back was this fiberglass shell with a pop top. It was all built in, and it was in my price range, and it had some miles on it. I wish it had fewer miles, but I was like, wow, that thing's small enough that it could be my daily driver and be an RV. And so I went and looked at it. Some guy in Waltham, Massachusetts had it, and this is an older guy, and I bought it. There was no question about me buying it. He gave me this funny look as I was driving away, like, boy, I'm going to miss that thing. That, I think, was the look he gave me. It could have actually also been that he knew there was a problem with the rear end and he was wondering if I'd figure it out. But that's, nothing to worry about there. So this truck, this rig, was kind of unique, and it's a shame they don't make them anymore. They're a little bit of a collector item now, but I want to tell you about what was inside this thing. Inside the cab where you sat, it was the base trim level. So there was nothing in there that was fancy. No electric windows and no air conditioning. And it was a manual shift, a 4-speed manual shift, which was fine. I knew how to drive a stick. Someone, I'm assuming the manufacturer of the RV, put in an aftermarket air conditioner in there that actually worked. And all this thing basically was it was a knob with a fan and a knob that made it colder, and then a vent that was a different vent than all the ones that were in the dashboard. So your air conditioning came out someplace different, which was a little weird. And it was heavily carpeted. Everything was this orange kind of shag carpet all over everything. But other than that, it was the same thing that a regular old pickup truck would be. Very limited gauges, you know, it had the fuel and temperature and the tachometer and speedometer, and that's it, and a whole bunch of LED lights. And it drove like a car. It was actually pretty darn comfy. And I had no problem driving it just like it was a car. I learned how to use mirrors. It came with really nice mirrors. And because it was cutaway, you could just go into the back of the rig. Now, this did have a cab over. There was a little piece of this that went over the cab, but it was not an area for you to sleep in. You could store stuff there, but you couldn't really sleep in it. And then you went in back, and there was a dinette immediately, and then there was a kitchen. It had a stove and an oven and lights and an exhaust fan, and of course the dinette turned into a bed, a pretty narrow one, but it did turn into a bed. And then there was a bathroom. And now, it actually had a separate room for a bathroom in this little tiny rig. Now, the way that worked was interesting. This rig had the door in the back, not on the sides. There were no side doors other than where the driver and passenger got in. But in the back, there was a door. And as you opened that door, there would be, on your right, a closet, and on the left, the bathroom. But you couldn't sit in the bathroom with the door closed. The door closed directly up against the toilet. And so the idea was that when you used it, you would sit back there on the toilet and then leave the door halfway open. But the door was sized such that it would basically close off the back of the rig, and you would actually have some privacy back there, as much as you can in a vehicle, obviously. No shower. It did not have a shower, and that was a disappointment to me. I really, really wanted a shower. I didn't know any better back then, honestly. I wouldn't want a shower now so much, but back then, I really wanted a shower, and that was a disappointment. I wish I had known what I know now. That rig would have been much more useful for me. Now, the chemical toilet back there was what they called at the time a marine toilet, and this thing was no cassette toilet. The way this thing worked is it had one tank, and that's what you flushed with. So it had this blue powder that you'd put in there, which I found out later was blue dye and formaldehyde. And you would dump that in, right in the bowl, and then fill it up with a gallon of water. And every time you used it, you would pump that. But it was basically pumping the waste to use to flush the waste. It's pretty gross if you think about it, but that's how it worked. And it didn't require any water. I mean, other than that gallon you put in there, you didn't have to add water. And when you wanted to empty it, you'd take the entire thing into your house and sit it on top of a toilet and pull a lever, and all that stuff would get flushed out. I haven't seen one of these toilets in forever now, and I imagine that most people don't use them anymore. I mean, it was fine. It worked for what I needed it for, but cassette toilets are so much better, never mind composting toilets or anything else. It had two batteries, one in the front, one in the back, and they were just regular old starter batteries. They weren't anything fancy at all. There was an isolator under the hood that separated the two, and then it had a feature I've never seen in anything else. So remember I said it was a pop top. So you could pop the top up, and you could stand in there, and that was great. And then you'd lower it while you were driving. A perfect solution. No leaks. This thing worked great. It had the zipper down windows to let air in. It was nice. And then it had fold out bunks. There was this system where these steel rods or beams would come out and you'd set them up on either side. And then canvas cots would roll out and sit on those. So you could actually sleep four people on this, two people on the dinette very comfortably, and then two people in the cots above. That actually worked. So this little tiny Toyota, technically a Class B, slept four and had a bathroom in it. And it probably is smaller than your van. You know, it really worked as a vehicle. And when I had it, it was already pretty old. I think it was a 77. And I got it in 85? 86. I got it in 86. So it was 9 years old when I got it. But man, that thing, it was great. I drove it around and around. And the only reason I got rid of it was that I really wanted a shower. And what I traded it in for was a bigger, well, actually it was a Class C. That's kind of funny. I think of the Chinook as a Class B, but the one I replaced it with a Class C. It was a Micro C, which was another Toyota. Anyway, you may see some of these Chinooks still out on the road. They were really fun rigs. I wish people made them now, but you know what they don't make anymore is the little pickup trucks that made this thing work. You know, if I had one now, I think it would be all I need. You know, we have lost a lot. There used to be a lot more vehicles out there that suited our lifestyle, and there was a lot more option, and I really regret how things have gone, where we're stuck with just three or four basic vans, and manufacturers just aren't doing anything creative anymore. I mean, that's not true, but there are no low-cost, built-out rigs anymore, and there used to be. There used to be that somebody who had modest means could buy one of these things and hit the road all set to go. And now it seems like you need at least $100,000, and then you're getting a fairly stripped down rig. So I miss those days. You know, I love my new rigs. I've loved every rig I've had, but I do have a lot of nostalgia for this thing, and I do wish somebody would come out with something similar. It got 30 miles a gallon, it slept four, you could cook in it. I mean, it was an amazing vehicle to get you out there on the road, and I hope things turn around and we can see things like that again. A place to visit. If you do come out to RMSS, or if you don't come to RMSS and you're just somebody who likes to see very strange places, in Bishop, California, there is this place called Bishop's Castle. I think I've talked about it before in the podcast, but it's been a while. The story is this man named Bishop bought this piece of land and wanted to build a cottage on it, and he was just doing it by the seat of his pants. He was just building it the way he wanted, and people would come by and say, "You know, Jim, that looks like a castle more than a cottage." And he looked and he thought and he said, you know, you're right. And so he decided he was going to build a castle. And he has. And he's been doing this for decades and he hasn't stopped. And he has created this massive, bizarre complex all by hand, all using found objects and whatever design comes into his head. And he's created a tourist destination called Bishop's Castle. Now, it's not a tourist destination. I mean, it is. You can go see it. There's a gift shop. There's a little admission. You can go see it. I mean, that's all fine. But it's not its purpose. Its purpose is that he's building it. That's all he cares about. He's not a particularly friendly guy. I mean, he'll talk to you if you talk to him, but it's very likely you will go there and see him on his hands and knees applying concrete to something. And he'd rather you left him alone. That was my impression. The place is kind of amazing. If you're familiar with the cathedral in Bilbao, I think it is, Bilbao, Spain, the Gaudi-inspired one, it looks like it's a big tan cathedral that kind of looks like it's melting. That's what this place looks like. And it's full of all kinds of little weird things to explore. I mean, there are steeples and big halls and crawlways. It's just a really amazing testament to human creativity. And I have to add risk-taking, because this was built on a part of land that has no building codes whatsoever, and this thing is pretty dangerous. I mean, he's built everything as strong as he knows how to, but there's stuff that there's no way he could have accounted for everything, and where it's a one-time build, you are the person testing this, and there's a waiver or a sign as you come in that explains that if you get hurt, it's on you. And I couldn't find any records of injuries on the place, but I'm sure there have been some. So this is a place to go that if you like to explore, that's great, but know that it is a place of risk. I had a really good time there. I took a group of folks there a few years ago, and we loved it and got all kinds of crazy pictures. But this is definitely not a place to take little kids, and if you do take kids of any age, make sure they are very well supervised. If you're curious about this, you can find out more at thebishopcastle.com, and I'll have a link in the show notes. Resource recommendation. Before I did van life, I did bush life, and I don't mean in the Australian sense, except that I kind of do. I was very interested in wilderness survival in my youth, part of my Boy Scout experience, and I would go camping with nothing but a knife, head out into the woods with some supervision, you know, and I was close enough that if anything bad happened, I could walk home, as long as I could walk, or walk back to camp, as the case may be. And I went out there with just a knife, and I made a meal of berries and frog legs, caught frogs, and cooked them on a fire. We were allowed to bring matches in this particular time I'm talking about, so I did have two matches, and that was enough to start a fire that I kept going the whole time. I did produce sparks or a coal with a bow drill, so if I had really needed to make fire, I'm confident that I could have. And I made a shelter out of hemlock branches, which is naturally waterproof, and slept the night in there. And it wasn't comfortable, but it was fine. I mean, I've had worse nights in a bed, that's for sure. And I kind of thought about all that kind of stuff a lot as a kid and read a bunch of books and learned different ways to find water and what kinds of food are good to eat. Like, you can make tea out of the inner bark of a white pine tree, and birds are typically easy to kill if you're trying to find food. Porcupines are very easy to eat and kill, but you've got to remove the armpit kernels, all this kind of stuff. And some of this stuff is actually useful for van life, but the one I found the most useful is really well documented at backpacker.com. They have an article called How to Find Water, Desert Survival Expert Advice. And I like this article because it's short and easy to grasp, and it gives you some ideas on how to get water when you don't have any. And it's their crazy ideas. I mean, these are probably things you haven't thought of for getting water. It's not about collecting rain or getting water from a pond. It's about finding the sand dunes on the seashore and finding the lowest spot behind them and digging a hole just deep enough until it's damp. And then cover that hole with whatever you have, plastic or leaves or whatever. Come back in an hour and there's a good chance there will be drinkable water right there. Now, all this water, I recommend you boil it no matter what, but it's true. Behind sand dunes in the ocean, there is a layer of fresh water above the salt water that's below, so you can't dig too deep. You have to stop digging as soon as the sand gets damp. And that's the kind of stuff that you would either learn from vast experience or from reading an article like this. There's a bunch more stuff like that in there. Give it a look. It's backpacker.com. The URL is crazy long. I have a link in the show notes, but if you want to find it with Google or whatever, search backpacker.com, how to find water, and it will probably come up. Well, folks, thank you very much for joining me here for episode 288. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. I have extensive travel coming up, but if you would like to get a hold of me, visit built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3.1, and you'll find links to email, Facebook, and a few other things that I have honestly forgotten about. Until next time, remember the words of Queen Margaret, as presented by the Bard in King Henry VI, Part 3, who said, "Wise men ne'er sit and wail their loss, but cheerly seek how to redress their harms."